Okay, so imagine you're standing on, say, the Golden Gate Bridge, or you're just looking at the chassis of your car. To the naked eye, that steel, it looks solid.
Completely solid, static.
Yeah, unchanging. It's the definition of hard. But if you could shrink down, way, way down to the atomic level, you wouldn't see a statue. You'd see this chaotic, bustling highway.
Oh, it's an absolute illusion of solidity. Because down there in the crystal lattice, it is just bedlam. Atoms are jumping, squeezing through these tiny gaps, vibrating, rushing past each other. It's so active.
And that is exactly what we're unpacking today. We're looking at the secret life of atoms inside steel. Specifically, we're doing a deep dive into the mechanics of diffusion. And before you tune out thinking this is, just dry textbook physics, this movement is literally what keeps that bridge standing.
It is. Or if it goes wrong, it's what causes a crack.
The stakes are that high.
The stakes are huge. There's this one concept in the research that, I mean, it blew my mind the first time I heard it. Almost no useful steel is actually at equilibrium.
Equilibrium, meaning finished, done changing.
Meaning happy, thermodynamically speaking, stable. Most steels are in a state of transition. They're all trying to get somewhere else chemically. They want to change.
That's slightly terrifying. You're telling me my car is currently in a state of transition.
Well, ideally, a very, very slow one. But yes, the stability of the steel, whether a part holds up or fails, whether a knife stays sharp, it depends entirely on the rate at which these internal changes happen. And that rate is all about diffusion. If you understand how carbon moves through iron, you really understand the soul of the material.
Okay, so our mission today is to track that movement. We've got a stack of research here, cover some heavy hitters, fix laws, something called the Kirkendall effect.
Which sounds like a conspiracy theory.
It really does. And then the specific and really weird behavior of carbon atoms.
And we have to talk about the geometry, because it turns out the rules of the road change drastically depending on how the iron atoms are arranged. You know, whether it's ferrite or austenite or martensite, it's this whole mix of geometry, elasticity, and thermodynamics.
All right, let's get into it. Let's start with the basic traffic rules. How do atoms actually move inside a solid rock of metal?
At the most fundamental level, we use Fick's first law. It's the basic rule of traffic. It just says that flux, the flow of atoms, is proportional to the concentration gradient.
Okay, concentration gradient. Break that down for
It
me.
just means atoms move from where there are a lot of them to where there are few of them. Think of it like a really crowded party. If the kitchen's packed with people and the living room is empty, people will naturally, drift toward the living room until it evens out. They move down the gradient.
Like dropping a tea bag into hot water, the flavor just spreads out.
Basically, yeah. But in a solid, they can't just swim around. They have to jump. And this leads us to that Kirkendall effect you mentioned.
Right. Now, in the notes, this was described as an aha moment that changed material science. What actually happened there?
So back in the day, scientists thought diffusion was just atoms swapping places.
Right.
Like if you had a block of copper and a block of nickel touching each other, they figured a copper atom would jump right and a nickel atom would jump left.
A polite one-for-one exchange.
Exactly. But an experiment by Smigelskas and Kirkendall just proved this was wrong. They took a block of copper, a block of nickel, and right at the seam where they touched, they placed inert markers. They used molybdenum wires.
Just little wires.
Just little wires. They don't react. They don't diffuse. They're just landmarks, like mile markers on a highway. Then they heated the whole thing up to let the atoms mix.
Okay, yeah.
And when they checked back later, the markers had moved.
Moved. But you said they were inert.
They are, but they moved relative to the lab bench. Imagine you're watching this through a microscope. The wires actually shifted their position.
Wait, if the wires didn't move themselves,
Yeah.
that implies the ground they were sitting on moved?
Precisely. And that was the bombshell. It turned out that copper atoms were diffusing out of their side much faster than nickel atoms were coming in to replace them.
So it wasn't a one-for-one swap at all.
No. It was completely lopsided. Copper is just faster. So if you have 10 atoms leaving the left side, but only 5 atoms arriving, what happens to the left side?
He has to shrink.
It physically shrinks. The lattice itself has to collapse and shift to compensate for that missing mass.
That is wild. It's like you're on one of those moving walkways at the airport. You're the atom. You're walking forward. That's diffusion. But the lattice is actually moving backward underneath you.
That is the perfect analogy. The research actually distinguishes between two frames of reference.
Right?
There's the laboratory frame, that's us standing still watching, and then there's the lattice fixed frame, that's your moving treadmill belt. The speed of that belt is called the Kirkendall velocity.
But hold on. If atoms are leaving faster than they're arriving, doesn't that leave holes?
It does. It creates vacancies. You can visualize it as a flow of empty spots going in the opposite direction of the fast atoms. And this isn't just, you know, academic trivia. If you have enough of these vacancies, they start to clump together. They condense into actual physical pores voids in the metal.
So you could weld two metals together thinking it's strong, but because of this effect, it could essentially eat itself from the inside out and create holes.
It happens all the time in electronics. You solder a connection, and over years, the Kirkendall effect creates voids, the contact breaks, and your device just fails. It connects atomic movement directly to structural failure.
Wow. Okay, that is a great example of why should I care? So Kirkendall is about big atoms, copper, nickel squeezing past each other. But steel's different, right? Because carbon is tiny.
Carbon is the VIP of the steel world. And yes, the size difference changes everything. An iron atom is big. A carbon atom is small, about 60% the size of the iron. So carbon doesn't wait for a vacancy. It doesn't swap places. It plays by different rules.
It's an interstitial driver.
Yeah.
It just weaves through traffic.
Exactly. It fits into the interstices, the little gaps between the iron atoms. And because it doesn't need to wait for an empty seat, it moves thousands of times faster than other elements. It can even reorganize itself at room temperature.
Which brings us to ferrite. This is just standard room temperature iron. The research highlights a specific paradox here that I'm struggling with. It's the real estate problem.
Oh, this is a classic. So inside the iron lattice, which is a BCC or body-centered cubic structure, there are two types of gaps where a carbon atom could theoretically park. We call them the octahedral site and the tetrahedral site.
Okay, two parking spots.
Now, if you just look at the math, the tetrahedral site is physically larger. It has more total volume.
So logically, carbon should park there.
Hmm.
I mean, if I'm trying to park a big SUV, I'm looking for the biggest space I can find.
You would think so. But carbon ignores the big spot and forces its way into the smaller octahedral site.
Why? That seems completely counterintuitive.
It's not about the total volume. It's about the shape of the distortion it creates. Think of it like this. You're trying to fit a rigid sleeping bag into a car. You have two options. The trunk, let's call that the tetrahedral site, has a lot of space, but the opening is the wrong shape. To get it in, you'd have to, like, push against the metal walls of the car.
Okay, that's going to take a lot of force.
Right. The metal doesn't want to bend. Now, look at the back seat. The octahedral site. It's technically smaller, but it's squishy. It has soft cushions. To fit the sleeping bag there, you just have to push two cushions apart.
So even though the space is tighter, it's easier to stretch it into shape.
Exactly. The octahedral site is irregular. It's shorter in one direction. When the carbon atom jams itself in there, it only has to push two iron atoms apart to make room. It creates what's called a tetragonal distortion.
So it's annoying two neighbors a lot instead of annoying four neighbors just a little bit.
And in terms of elasticity theory, annoying two neighbors costs way less energy. So carbon sits in the octahedral site, but this creates a huge headache for diffusion.
Because now it has to move.
Right. And to get from one octahedral site to the next one, it can't just teleport. It has to pass through the space in between.
And the space in between. Don't tell me. It's the tetrahedral site.
Yep. The site it hates.
Oh, I see. So the commute isn't just hopping from safe spot to safe spot. It's safe spot. Through the danger zone to the next safe spot.
It's O to T to O. And because that T site is so high energy, it's an uncomfortable squeeze for the carbon, it acts like this massive energy barrier. This is why the diffusion data for carbon looks so weird. If you plot it on a graph, it's not a straight line at high temperatures. It curves because the atom is navigating this complex multi-stage obstacle course.
And I saw the notes mention the yield point effect here, too. Is that related to this tight fit?
It is. So imagine your car has been sitting in that tight parking spot for a while. The carbon atoms settle in. They get comfortable. They actually pin the defects in the metal, the dislocations in place.
Like putting a boot on the wheel of a car.
That's a great way to put it. So when you try to bend the steel, initially it resists. It's hard to get moving. You have to apply extra force to break free from those carbon atoms locking the wheels. That sudden give you feel is the yield point.
It's amazing how these tiny atomic parking problems determine how a piece of metal bends in your hands. But speaking of parking problems, we have to talk about martensite. Because if ferrite is an obstacle course, martensite sounds like a prison.
Martensite is fascinating. This is what you get when you quench steel. You heat it up and dunk it in water. You cool it so fast, the carbon doesn't have time to leave.
So it's trapped.
It's trapped. And the whole lattice becomes distorted. Instead of being a nice cube, it gets stretched into a rectangle body-centered tetragonal.
A really stressed-out lattice.
Very stressed. Now, remember those octahedral sites? In Fairy, they were all basically the same. But in this stretched Martin site, they're different. The sites along the stretched axis, let's say the vertical axis, get pulled open. They become these huge, comfortable armchairs for the carbon.
Okay, so the carbon's happy now. It's got a big chair.
It is too happy. That's the problem. The sites on the horizontal axis get squeezed shut. So the carbon settles into this deep, comfortable energy well on that vertical axis.
I see where this is going. If it wants to diffuse.
It has to leave the comfy armchair and jump into the squeezed high-pressure site right next door.
It's like trying to get out of a warm bed on a freezing cold morning to jump into an ice bath. You don't want to do it.
And thermodynamically, the atom refuses. This increases the energy barrier by a huge amount. That's why diffusion in martensite is so much slower than in ferrite. The carbon is effectively locked in place by its own distortion of the lattice.
And that locking is why martensite is so hard, right? Nothing can move.
Nothing moves. It's rigid. It's brittle. It's a frozen atomic traffic jam.
Now, I want to pivot to something that I found genuinely funny in the reading.
Yeah.
We've talked about how carbon interacts with iron, but we haven't talked about how carbon interacts with other carbon. And honestly, they seem like jerks.
They really are. They're incredibly antisocial.
The text mentions they have a closest approach rule. They just refuse to be neighbors.
It's true. In a solid solution, you will almost never find two carbon atoms sitting right next to each other.
Why? Is it magnetic or something?
It's a mix of things. There's some electrostatic repulsion charges pushing against charges, but it's mostly that strain field we talked about. Remember, the carbon is pushing the iron atoms apart.
Right, the whole squishy sofa thing.
So if you're sitting on the sofa pushing the cushions apart, and I try to sit right next to you and push the same cushions, the tension is just too high. The lattice can't take it. So carbon atoms keep their distance. They socially distance.
The notes mention something called the Snook effect in this context. Is that a way to measure this antisocial behavior?
It's a way to measure their movement. It's really clever. Because these atoms distort the lattice, if you vibrate the steel like, literally shake it or ring it like a bell, you apply stress.
Right.
When you stretch the metal in one direction, you open up certain sites. And the carbon atoms, seeing better real estate, will jump into those open sites.
So you're basically shaking the box to make the marbles settle.
But here's the kicker. Jumping takes time. So there's a lag between you pulling the metal and the carbon actually jumping. That lag absorbs energy. By measuring how quickly the ringing dies out, the damping, you can calculate exactly how fast the carbon is jumping. But this only works because they distort the lattice so much.
So we have ferrite, the obstacle course, and martensite, the trap. But there's a third character here. Austenite, high-temperature steel. And the source calls out a mystery, the austenite anomaly.
Yeah, austenite is totally different. It's face-centered cubic, or FCC. The holes, the parking spots, are all regular and symmetrical.
So no weird squeezing.
Well, the hole is spherical, so when carbon goes in, it just pushes all its neighbors equally. It doesn't create that directional distortion. But the anomaly is all about speed.
Okay, usually if you add more cars to a highway, traffic slows down.
Correct. But in austenite, as you add more carbon, the diffusion coefficient goes up.
Wait, the crowding makes them move faster.
At high concentrations, carbon moves 5 times faster than at low concentrations.
That makes zero sense.
It does, if you remember how antisocial they are.
Ah, the repulsion.
Think about it. If you're a carbon atom and you want to move forward, but there are 3 other carbon atoms right behind you, what are they doing?
They're repelling me, pushing me.
They are shoving you away. The thermodynamic activity just skyrockets. It's like a mosh pit. If everyone hates being near everyone else and you pack them in tight, the pressure to escape, to move down the gradient, becomes intense. They essentially shove each other through the lattice.
So an austenite, hate is the fuel.
The thermodynamic factor, as the papers call it, yeah. It completely overrides the crowding effect. It's a really counterintuitive result.
We've just seen 3 totally different behaviors just by rearranging the iron atoms. It's kind of mind-blowing.
It is. In ferrite, it's an elastic struggle, finding the path of least resistance.
No.
In martensite, it's a trap falling into a deep energy well. And in austenite, it's a race driven by pure repulsion.
And all of this, The vacancies eating the metal, the carbon locking the wheels, the mosh pit. This is happening right now in the steel beams above our heads.
Every single second. It determines how we heat treat gears for transmissions, how we temper swords so they don't shatter, how we build nuclear reactors that can withstand radiation damage. We are essentially manipulating these atomic commutes to engineer the world around us.
It really changes how you look at a piece of metal. It's not just a chunk of gray stuff. It's a dynamic system.
It's a frozen moment in a never-ending process.
Before we wrap up, though, there is one thing that's been nagging me this whole time. We spent the last 10 minutes establishing that carbon atoms hate each other. They repel. They don't sit next to each other. They push each other away.
So that's the dominant force in the solid solution, yes.
So if they hate each other so much, how on earth do we get carbides? You know, it's a cementite, F3C. That's a chemical compound where carbon atoms are packed right together in a crystal.
That is the ultimate question, isn't it?
If the driving force is repulsion, what flips the switch? How do you go from get away from me to let's build the crystal together?
That transition from a solid solution where they repel to a compound where they bond is where the thermodynamics gets incredibly complex. It involves nucleation, phase changes, and completely different energy balances. It's like a switch flips and the rules of the game just change entirely.
Sounds like a mystery for another deep dive.
I think it definitely is.
Thanks for listening. Next time you see a bridge, just remember, it's not standing still. It's just moving really, really slowly. See you next time.